So in the last 2 weeks we looked at some Vedanta traditions who are also Vaishnava traditions. We looked at Ramanujan, we looked at Madhva, and now for initially I was planning for 2 weeks, but it might end up 3 weeks. We'll look at Shaivism, but before we look into the specific Shaiva tradition, I mean, one thing that you'll notice is, I hope, is that Shaiva traditions are quite different from Vaishnava traditions in their theology, in their terminology, and in their attitudes towards particular ritual practices, particularly Vedic ritual practices. And I want to focus a little bit on that first, look at the reason behind that, why Shaiva. I mean, Shaiva traditions are also the traditions that are generally not so well known, popularly speaking. If you take a book on Hinduism, a popular book on Hinduism, the emphasis will be on Vedanta, and as I'll show in just a moment, Vedanta is largely Vaishnava Vedanta. Vedanta is really a Vaishnava thing. Even Shankara, who's not a strictly speaking a Vaishnava, he's in some ways he's kind of a Vaishnava, and he, you know, if he teaches that one should worship a particular deity, he would always say it should be, you know, you should worship Vishnu, and his sources are much more Vaishnava than they are Shaiva. Even though later on in the 14th, 15th, 16th century, there's a move in his tradition to a closer alignment with particular Shaiva traditions. But Shankara himself is much more Vaishnava than... Paul Hacker wrote quite a good study of sort of looking at Shankara from that perspective. Shankara as a Vaishnava, and sort of Vaishnava elements in Shankara's teachings. But the Vaishnava and the Shaiva traditions are the most numerous or the most popular traditions in what we now call classical Hinduism. Most of the theology, Hindu theology that develops is developed in those schools. But if you look at the Vedic texts, you have Vishnu and Rudra, which is sort of a name for Shiva in Shaivism, are two deities in the Vedic texts, but they're not the most prominent deities. The Vedic rituals are all about mainly about Indra and Agni and Soma and Varuna and so on. And the entire Rig Veda, which consists of over 1,000 hymns, contains only 6 hymns entirely devoted to Vishnu, and only 3 entirely devoted to Rudra. And so they're very, in a sense, very minor deities. But they're very, particularly Vishnu, actually. And this person. Jan Konda, a Dutch scholar, quite a lot of, he was very prolific, did a lot of non-Vedic studies, but he particularly, he did a number of things on Vishnu in Vedic texts and so on, and he argues that although Vishnu is not the most prominent deity in terms of numbers of times that he's invoked and so on, he's a very central deity to the Vedic rituals and the Vedic religious worldview. And he's a very important deity, even though he's not invoked that often. I gave you on the hand that you have two passages from the Rig Veda there, from the first book. One is a hymn to Vishnu, and one is one to Rudra. This is Griffith's translation, so this is over 100 years old, and the language, particularly the Vishnu one, is very archaic. But it's a different Griffiths. Rolf Griffiths. So it's very archaic, which you either, some people like that. But Anyway, but what I want to do is read through the both passages and pay attention to not to the specifics so much as what is said about Vishnu or what is said about Rudra, but about the attitudes that the author of the hymn takes towards these deities. So you have Vishnu, far shining, widely famed, going thy wonted way, fed with the oil, be helpful. Be Mitra-like to us, be like a friend to us. So Vishnu, O Vishnu, even the wise must swell thy song of praise, and he who hath oblations pay thee solemn rites. He who brings gift to him, the ancient and the last, to Vishnu who ordains, together with his spouse, who tells the lofty birth of him, the lofty one, shall verily surpass in glory even his peer.
It almost sounds like an Anglican hymn.
that might have been the intention, I think. Him have ye satisfied, singers, as well as ye known, no primeval germ of order even from his birth. Ye knowing even his name have told it forth, may we, O Vishnu, enjoy the grace of thee, the mighty one. The sovereign Varuna and both the Ashvins wait on this the will of him who guides the Marut host. Vishnu has power supreme and might that finds the day, and with his friend, which is probably Indra, unbars the stable of the kine. The kine are the cattle or the cows, and it's a common image and refers to many things in Vedic texts. Possibly here, it's a reference to the cattle that represent rain and water and their fertility that are set loose by Indra. Even he, the heavenly one who came for fellowship, Vishnu to Indra, godly to the godlier, who maker, throned in three worlds, helps the Aryan man and gives the worshipper his share of holy law. Now what you get from this hymn is that the attitude towards Vishnu is one of great reverence. But Vishnu is almost like a friend. I mean, in the first verse, the author of the hymn invokes him that you're like be like a friend to us, be like Mitra, like literally a friend to us. But Mitra is also, of course, the name of a deity, and he's a very benevolent deity. He's a deity that's very generous and very kind and very gracious. But he's also very much invoked in the context of the Vedic rituals themselves. Indra is, of course, the chief object of Vedic sacrifice. He's the chief deity to whom sacrifices are performed or offered. But in the end, you have this the last phrase, he helps the Aryan man and gives the worshipper, the one who sacrifices, his share of holy law. He assists in the performance of sacrifice. He maintains the order of Vedic rituals, and by doing that maintains the order of the world and so on. Now, keep that in mind when we'll read through the hymn to Rudra now. And as I said, there's only three hymns to Rudra, but this one is one that brings the different views of Rudra and the other hymns together in the most straightforward way. To the strong Rudra bring we these our songs of praise. To him, the Lord of Heroes, with the braided hair, his matted hair, that it be well with all our cattle and our men, that in this village all be healthy and well fed. Be gracious unto us, O Rudra, bring us joy. Thee, Lord of Heroes, thee with reverence will we serve. Whatever health and strength our father Manu won by sacrifice, may we under thy guidance gain. Manu is the father of mankind. By worship of the gods, may we, O bounteous one, O Rudra, gain thy grace. Ruler of valiant men, come to our families, bringing them bliss. May we, whose heroes are uninjured, bring these sacred gifts. Hither we call for aid the wise, the wanderer, the impetuous Rudra, perfecter of sacrifice. May he repel from us the anger of the gods. Verily, we desire his favorable grace. Him with the braided hair we call with reverence down, the wild boar of the sky. This is a Vedic way of saying, it's often the gods are called boars or bulls. And it sort of denotes a real masculine strength. It's only said of male deities. The red, the dazzling shape, may he, his hand filled full of sovereign medicine, grant us protection, shelter, and a home secure. To him, the father of the Maruts, is this hymn addressed. The Maruts are storm gods. Is this hymn addressed to strengthen Rudra's might, a song more sweet than sweet. Grant us, immortal one, the food which mortals eat. Be gracious unto me, my seed, and my progeny. O Rudra, harm not either great or small of us, harm not the growing boy, harm not the full-grown man. Slay not a sire among us, slay no mother here, and to our own dear bodies, Rudra, do not harm. Harm is not, Rudra, in our seed and progeny, harm is not in the living, nor in cows or steeds. Slay not our heroes in the fury of your wrath, bringing oblations evermore, we call to thee. Even as a herdsman, I have brought thee hymns of praise. This is again a standard Vedic image that the songs of praise or the hymns are compared to cows that you gather together and sort of, it's a very Vedic thing. O Father of the Maruts, give us happiness, blessed is thy most favouring benevolence, so verily do we desire thy saving help. Far be thy dart that killeth men or cattle, thy bliss be with us, O thou Lord of heroes, be gracious unto us, O God, and bless us, and then vouchsafe us doubly strong protection. We, seeking help, have spoken and adored him. May Rudra, girt by Maruts, surrounded by the Maruts, hear our calling. This prayer of ours may Varuna grant, and Mitra, and Aditi, and Sindhu, earth and heaven. They're all Vedic deities. Now, what you get from this hymn is Rudra is, I don't know if you noticed, but sort of halfway through the hymn, the tone really changes very abruptly. The beginning is, Rudra, you're really great, and you're really kind, and you're such a wonderful person. And then the second half of the hymn is, please don't be angry at us, please don't kill us, please don't kill my mother, please don't kill my sons, please don't make me, please don't kill my seed, make me impotent or something like that, I suppose. Do not kill my children, do not kill my horses, do not kill my cattle, and so on. And this is very typical of Rudra in the Vedic text. Rudra is a powerful deity, but he's a very ambivalent deity. He's a deity that's not unreservedly praised. He's a deity that is feared. Khonda, he likes to put it saying that Vishnu is the friend, sort of a powerful friend, but he's more like a friend. He's closer to his worshippers. Whereas Rudra is like a lord who's very powerful, but who's kind of unpredictable, and so therefore you do not want to mess with this person. You do not want to get too close to him, and you do not want to get on the wrong side of him. And this is very typical also of Vedic ritual in general. There's no offerings made to Rudra in Vedic rituals, in the main Vedic rituals. If you perform a Vedic ritual, you've probably seen this last term, but you have your three fires, and there's a sacrificial enclosure that you erect around that. There's a gate here and a gate there. And this is where all the offerings are made. You have three fires. This is where the main offerings are made, into here. No offerings will be made to Rudra within this sacrificial enclosure. There are some rituals that involve offerings made to Rudra, but they will always be made outside of this enclosure. And so outside of this, you could sort of say sacred space that is created for the sacrifice. This has led some scholars to the opinion that Rudra is actually not an Indo-European deity, but is a deity, and this of course ties in with the whole debate on where the Aryan, where the Vedic people actually come from, are they indigenous to India, or are they coming from outside India. But it has led some scholars to argue that Rudra is a deity that was worshipped in India before the Aryan people came and was integrated into the Vedic sort of pantheon, and but sort of has this very ambivalent position in the pantheon and in the ritual world, because he's an outsider, really. Whereas Vishnu is very much at the center of Vedic rituals, as we've seen in that hymn. He's the one who maintains Vedic rituals. He's the one who helps those who perform Vedic rituals. And offerings are made to Vishnu in some of the important rituals. And so they're all made, you know, just where the offerings to the other gods are made. Sometimes people like to see the development of Vaishnavism and Shaivism as fairly sort of divorced from its Vedic context. But I think that what you see here in these Vedic texts is a real clue to, it gives you a deeper insight into the development of these two traditions. Because if you think back of Ramanuja and Madhva, what are their primary sources for authority? Their primary sources are the Upanishads. The Upanishads are part of the Vedic corpus, and they'll engage with the Upanishads. They're a Vedantic tradition. The Vedanta, the conclusion of the Vedas, are the Upanishads. And this is their primary source of theology, of knowledge of God, and of knowledge on how to conduct yourself in this world. We'll see that the Shaivas are very different. They don't engage with the Upanishads much at all. There's a few authors later on, but this is like, you know, 15th, 16th century, who start to engage a bit with the Upanishads. But most, you know, don't care about the Upanishads, don't care about the Vedas. And so they develop they see themselves very explicitly as outsiders of the Vedic tradition. I gave you a passage below this in Rudra. You have this passage from the Kularnava Tantra, which is one of the Shaiva texts. And if you go to the third sentence there, the third line, the Veda is superior. So the Veda is a high path. Higher than the Veda is the path that worships Vishnu. The worship of Shiva is superior to the worship of Vishnu. And the right path, which we'll talk about more next week, it's a particular Shaiva path or tantric path, is superior to Shiva worship. The left path, which is the other tantric path, is superior to the right. The doctrinal path, the Siddhanta, which we'll talk about next week of Shaiva, is superior to the left. The heart path, which is the path that this particular tantra talks about, is superior to the doctrinal, and there's nothing higher than the heart. Now, the important thing about this passage is that it places these different paths and its associated texts in a hierarchy, with the Vedas being the very bottom of the hierarchy. And now, the Vedas, as I'm sure you're very familiar, are often seen as the defining criteria of Hindu traditions. Brian Smith has his famous definition of Hinduism being consisting of traditions that create, perpetuate, and transform themselves with legitimizing authority to the Veda. Now here you have these Shaivas who say, well, the Veda, that's the foundation. That's the lowest of the hierarchy. Above that is the path of the Vaishnavas and their own text. Above those are the path of Shiva, and then the Shaiva path comes in many different forms, and even there you have a hierarchy. This is a very typical Shaiva way of looking at things, particularly a Shaiva tantric way of understanding this, where they see themselves not as, you know, they follow a group of texts that are different from the Vedic texts. They're the Shaiva tantras or the agamas. And this is the source for all their theology, for all their ritualism. And they see these texts as being superior to the Vedas. And in different Shaiva texts, this is expressed in different ways. In some, it's like here, it's just saying, well, the Veda is sort of, you know, the lowest. In some texts, there's actually a real dismissal of the Vedas. You find in some Shaiva texts comments like, whoever wrote the Veda must have been in illusion, and comments like that, which are very, very radical, particularly if you consider that the Veda, by most traditions, is considered to be unauthored. And so if you come along and say, well, actually, not just as a text authored, not just did somebody write the text, but the person who wrote it was under illusion, it's quite a radical statement to make. But you find these statements in some Shaiva texts. The Vaishnavas, on the other hand, they also have their own tantric texts. And as we saw last week, they have these Pancharatras, which are tantric texts that teach you how to worship Vishnu in the temple and through mantras and through visualization and meditation. And in some ways, they're very similar to Shaiva tantric texts. But the Vaishnavas will insist that these texts are not in contradiction or in any way conflict with the Vedic revelation. They're on an equal level, and they merely... the word tan means, the root tan means to spread out. And so they say they merely sort of elaborate or spread out the teachings of the Vedas and give more information that the Vedas don't give. And so for the Vaishnavas, they're on an equal level. I was just reading this. This is Yamuna, if you remember. He was Ramanuja's teacher. In some ways, they could meet. But he wrote this book, the Agama Pramanya, the validity of the Agamas. And the Agamas for him is the Pancharatra text. And he writes this whole book arguing that the Pancharatra text are equally authoritative as the Vedic text and should not be dismissed. Whereas the Shaivas say, no, our tantric texts are different. They teach a different path. It's not the same path as the Vedic path. We're beyond the Vedic path. Which means that engagement with Vedic texts and performance of Vedic rituals is very rare in Shaiva traditions. They won't develop, other than one person, they won't develop a Shaiva Vedanta system, because that Vedanta is all about the Upanishads, which are part of the Vedic revelation, and they generally don't care about a text like the Bhagavad Gita or something like that. You know, all the popular texts, that sort of the text popular in sort of popular Hinduism nowadays, particularly in the diaspora, are texts that Shaivas don't really care about. And for them, it's all about these Shaiva tantras, or in the case of Pashupata Shaivan, which we'll look at today, sort of texts written by their own teachers. Alexis Anderson likes to put it, the Shaivas consider themselves outsiders of the Vedic revelation. The Vaishnavas consider themselves privileged insiders. They'll say, we belong to the Vedic revelation, to the Vedic tradition, but we're privileged because we have the real understanding of the Vedas, whereas those Mimamsakas and those who perform, you know, those other guys who perform Vedic rituals that are not Vaishnavas actually miss the point, because Vedic rituals are actually all about Vishnu. And so that's why Madhva, if you remember from last week, decides to write a commentary on the Rig Veda. This is something a Shaiva would not do, because they don't care about it. But Madhva writes a commentary on the Rig Veda saying, this is how you should read this text, because he considers himself part of the tradition. And of course, in the Puranas, you get all these stories about Vishnu and Shiva, where Vishnu is always, in the Gita you have this, he comes down to when there's a decline in dharma and a rise of adharma, Vishnu descends and he reestablishes dharma. And this is the characteristic in all stories of Vishnu. He assists the gods, he restores order and so on. And Shiva is kind of this wild figure who's sort of doesn't quite fit into that whole order. There's a famous story of the sacrifice that Daksha, who's the progenitors, one of the people that has his task is to populate the world with sons and daughters. But he performs a sacrifice. His daughter is married to Shiva, and he insults Shiva, and Shiva walks away. He's kind of like, oh, well, don't want to engage with this guy. And comes back. The story is a bit involved. But later come back, destroys the sacrifice. This is an act that, you know, Vishnu, you can't conceive Vishnu doing that in Puranas. You know, sort of Shiva comes back, Well, actually, the story is Daksha's daughter is married to Shiva. Daksha insults Shiva, and his daughter, Shiva's wife, is really upset by it. Shiva doesn't care, but his wife is really upset, and so they leave. And later, Daksha is going to perform a big sacrifice, and his daughter wants to attend, but she realizes that, well, you know, Shiva would have to come along, and my father will just insult my husband again, and you know, this won't be nice. In the end, she decides to go anyway. Her father insults Shiva again. She decides to burn herself alive, and so she commits suicide. Shiva hears about this. Shiva gets angry, shows up at the sacrifice, and destroys the sacrifice, beheads Daksha, and later replaces his head with the head of a goat. But that's Shiva. And of course, part of the whole story is that the Vedic Brahmins start cursing Shiva's followers, and the followers of Shiva start cursing the Vedic Brahmins. And it's kind of, I mean, the story illustrates very well the development of these two traditions. The curses of the Brahmins to the Shaivas, to the followers of Shiva, is that you guys will reject the real scriptures, you'll reject the Vedas, you'll go around, walk around the world in a polluted way, covered in ash. You'll have no idea what real dharma is, and you'll be confused, and you'll continually insist that these false scriptures are the real texts. And the other way around, the Shaivas curse the Vedic Brahmins to be Mimamsakas, really, that you think that going to heaven is the be-all and end-all that you can obtain. You'll identify with the body you'll want to enjoy in this world, and so on. And so you kind of do, of course, this is from a Vaishnava Purana, so it's the Vaishnavas in one go can criticize both the Mimamsakas and the Shaivas through the story. That's the general characteristics that you find in these texts. Now, let's see. One final comment on this. As you can see from that passage from the Kulārṇava Tantra, the text says that the Vedas are there, and then higher than the Vedas are the Vaishnava text, or the Vaishnava path, and higher than that are all the Shaiva paths. This is very typically of Shaivas. The Shaivas tend to not have an issue with Vaishnava Tantric texts and the path of the Vaishnavas. And they'll just say, yeah, that's kind of okay, but it's very preliminary, and ultimately you'll have to come to a Shaiva path. The other way around, it's very different. The Vaishnavas don't accept the Shaiva text, the Shaiva Tantras at all. Madhva, for example, he says the Shaiva Tantric texts are Mohana Shastras. They're scriptures, texts that are meant to delude people, and they're created just to lead those that want to be led astray, to, you know, let them wander in darkness. But they're not authoritative texts, and they have their purpose, and so God allows them to exist, but they're not real they don't teach a real religious path. The Vaishnavas tend to be a lot more exclusive than the Shaivas. And this goes on until today. Somebody was telling me that there's a in North America there's a big Hindu temple where they decided to funding and stuff like that to in one complex have both a Shaiva and a Vaishnava temple. And at one point they had some difficulties with personnel. They didn't have enough of people to do it. And so the management went to, and the temple was really sort of segregated. Here you had the Vaishnava temple, there you had the Shaiva temple, but it was the same complex. And so you had the priests that were worshipped in the Vaishnava shrine and those in the Shaiva shrine. And the management, you know, went to both of them and said, well, look, you know, we don't have enough people to maintain the worship in both places. So what we propose is that occasionally the Vaishnavas worship in the Shaiva shrine and the Shaivas worship in the Vaishnava shrine, do the rituals there, just so that we can keep the temple running. And the response was, the Shaivas were like, oh yeah, fine, we can do this. The Vaishnavas were like, I'm not worshipping in a Shaiva shrine, you know, this is not for me, no, we're Vaishnavas, we don't engage with this. Because they see the Shaiva path with all the tantric texts as being a sort of a false path, Whereas the Shaivas see the Vaishnava path just as a limited path, as an imperfect path, but still a valid path.
Why is Shaivism so inclusive? What's the problem?
Sorry?
Why is Shaivism so inclusive, not exclusive?
It's a type of inclusive where it's sort of saying, they're okay, but they're very preliminary, and so ultimately you have to come to our path. It's not saying that the Vaishnava path will lead you to the same goal as our path, but why? I don't know.
I think that Hinduism is a more inclusive religion than Christianity, but it seems like the same. Or it might be the American Christian influence on the way.
No. This goes back a long time.
Oh, yes.
This goes back a long time, and you have similar stories in sort of classical times of conflicts between Vaishnavas and Shaivas. That said, the Shaivas haven't always been so tolerant. There have been a number of Shaiva kings in the south who were known for persecuting other, forms of.
So it means Shaivism derives from the southern part of India.
No.
I'm wondering what's the relationship between Shaivism and Kashmir Shaivism.
We'll talk about Kashmir Shaivism next week. That's of course happening all the way in the north. I mean, Shaivism is something that spreads all over India, like Vaishnava tradition spread all over India in various forms. I want to look a bit at the Pashupatas. The Pashupatas, their name derives from the name of Shiva, Pashupati, the Lord, the Pati of the Pashus, of the beasts. And the beasts, the wild animals, a Pashu is a term that Shaivas use often to refer to the self, to the living beings. And so Shiva is the Lord of the beast, meaning the Lord of all beings, of all living beings. The Pashupatas are kind of the oldest Shaiva tradition that we know. They're mentioned in the Mahabharata. Interestingly enough, often in a list that in sort of listed with yoga and Sankhya, and there's a strong influence of both yoga and Sankhya on Pashupata Shaivism. For a long time, we don't have a lot of texts from this school that survived. We have one text, the Pashupata Sutra, which is a very sort of, they're sutras, so they're very concise statements, sort of threads to guide a teacher in teaching this path. And we have a commentary on that by a person called Karandinya, who lived somewhere before the 6th century, probably 4th to 6th century, somewhere in that period, AD. It's a little confusing because the term Pashupata is used for a lot of different schools, for a lot of different forms of Shaivism that we have no text of, and so we don't quite know before the 4th century what form that Pashupata Shaivism took, but we know from the 4th century onwards what it kind of looked like. And the Pashupata Sutras, this central text for this tradition, is written by a person called Lakulisha. And Lakulisha, the tradition sees as being, in some ways, Shiva himself. The story goes that there was a Brahmin who died, a male Brahmin. He died, and his body was sort of left behind on the cremation ground. wasn't burnt, and Shiva then entered into that body and sort of revived that body and through that Brahmin's body taught then the Pashupata system. And then sort of taught disciples who then disseminated his teachings. That's how tradition sees it. So in other words, for them, this Pashupata Sutra, this text, is of nature of revelation. It comes from Shiva himself, rather than some mere mortal. We know of other texts that existed, but they've all we no longer have them. Now the Pashupata system is unlike the Vaishnava traditions that we looked at in the last 2 weeks. is a renouncer tradition. It's the Pashupata Sutras entirely talk. I mean, throughout the text, they're addressing renouncers. For if you're a householder and you want to follow the Pashupata path, the only thing you have to do, the only ritual you have to do, they say, is you have to, press your palms together and say, Namah Shivaya, obeisance to Shiva, and that's it. And so everything else, and it's quite a detailed injunction that they give and regulations that they give that the Pashupata should follow is all for ascetics. And they're a tradition that became very notorious, and you'll see in just a moment why, because their practice is a little weird, and intentionally so. The Pashupata Sutras start that one should lie down on ashes, one should sleep on ashes, one should bathe with ashes, one should wear garlands offered to the deity in the temple, one should reside in the temple, one should worship with laughter, songs, dance, the sound dun dun, which a commentator says is the sound of a bull, which I don't quite see, but with recitation, and one should worship with presents. One should wear only a single garment or none at all, and such a Pashupata ascetic should not look at feces or urine, and should not talk to a woman or a Shudra. And if he does talk to a woman or a Shudra, he should bathe with ash or do pranayama breathing practices or chant particular Shaiva verses. And by doing this will lead him to a purity of mind. If one still has an impure mind, the text says one should go and wander around, one should not stay in one place, and it concludes this is the means to attain yoga. This is kind of the preliminary path that they do. So they live as ascetics, they cover themselves in ash. The commentator Kondinya stresses that they should not bathe in water, but they should bathe in ashes, because ashes will keep themselves pure, will lead them to a state of purity. So they reside in a temple, and they're celibate. They don't interact with women at all. They shouldn't even talk to women, shouldn't even look at women, the text says. And they shouldn't talk to Shudras either. And this is a sort of an interesting thing. Kondinya, the commentator, stresses that the person who can follow this path should be a Brahmin, which is a little odd given what follows. Now, this type of practice of living an ascetic life and being covered in ash and living near a temple, and this is the first stage of their practice. They say once you've gone through this stage, you've obtained a certain spiritual realization, and once you're sort of fixed in this practice, you can then go to the second stage, and it's at the second stage that that things get interesting. Once they've acquired some spiritual insight, they should practice antinomian behavior. They should act like madmen. They should pretend to sleep and snore loudly. They should make lewd gestures to beautiful young women. They should act inappropriately in public, and so on. And I give you a couple of passages there because they're kind of fun. If you look at page 4, there's a section there, acting like a madman. So if you go to the second paragraph at the bottom there, you get a very standard, a very interesting passage. He should enter a village or a town. He is, of course, the Pashupata ascetic who is in the second stage of his practice. He should enter a village or a town and should stay neither very far nor very close to a group of people, so that that they would not be put in any trouble and yet would still see him. He should avoid the path of elephants, horses, chariots, and pedestrians, sit down and practice nodding, yawning, and so on, as if he were asleep. He shouldn't sit where elephants walk, because then he'll get trampled, I suspect. So he should be, not in the middle of the road. He should lie there, pretending to sleep, though keeping awake. Then he should make a snoring sound in his throat when he exhales. The people will then recognize him to be sleeping, either mentally or verbally, meaning they'll either think, oh, this guy's asleep, or they'll tell somebody else, look, this guy's sleeping. And they will insult him. because when you're an ascetic, you're not supposed to sleep in the middle of town. So they'll insult him. By this false practice, whatever merit they have comes to him, and whatever demerit he has goes to them. And so the idea is, they practice all these. They start acting like a madman who doesn't know, you know, how you should act in society. And so, you know, like here, this is a passage where they should pretend to be asleep and snore really loudly. Other texts say they should sort of trample and shake in a crowd. They should, when they see an attractive young woman, they should approach them and make very inappropriate sexual comments towards this girl. Things like that, they should, you know, start just acting like a crazy person. And what happens is people will insult them. People will criticize them, and the idea is that when that happens, their karma, their sort of impurities, that the residue of their previous actions will be burnt away by that. And as it says here, they'll whatever merit they have, whatever merit the people that curse or that insult him have, will come to him, and whatever demerit he has goes to them. So there's this transference of bad karma in a way. And they should continue to act like that until they come to a stage where they've obtained an even greater purity. And once they've obtained that, they should retire, they should find a solitary place and just sit there and meditate on Shiva until they die, until they obtain liberation. Now, you can imagine that if you...
Sure. Was the Pashupada the first tradition that came up with the holy madman, or did that exist before?
Well, it's an interesting question because I think it's different from the idea of a holy madman in that they're actually, and the texts are very clear about this. They're acting. They're not actually mad, but they're acting like as if they were mad. And so it's a slightly different thing than what you get later on, where you have these people that are seen to be mad, but they're not considered to be acting. They're just sort of their madness comes from their spiritual insight or their possession or whatever it is. But here they're really acting. And so they put on this show of you know, disrupting, you know, just civilians' lives. And but you can imagine that such a tradition doesn't get very popular. people don't like them very much. And so in a lot
of
texts...
Which century does
Kandinya, the commentator, lived somewhere between the 4th and the 6th century. And that's the period when, you know, sort of after that, they thrive for a while. And then later, you have other traditions that kind of base themselves on that, or sort of are linked with that break, sort of have their own particular style. But it's, you know, sort of middle of the first millennium that this really developed. I mean, there are references to Pashupatas earlier, but we don't have any texts of the Pashupatas before then, so we don't know whether, you know, this was the same as what we have in these texts, or whether this was something else that was just called by the same name. There's no way we can tell. Now, the important thing is too, because an important practice is that they have is they should act inappropriately for an ascetic with young beautiful girls, and so they should make sexual comments and
you know, what purpose?
Same purpose, to get insulted by those people, mm-hmm. and by that their bad karma is burnt away. So it's a means of attaining purity. That's their argument. But you see it very clearly there that it's really an acting, because and I give you a passage there, we won't read it now, but the next passage on women. This is Kandinya talking about women, how the Pashupata ascetic should look on women. And it's not a very favorable view. So it's very different from later forms of tantric Shaivism or other forms of tantric, where the ascetic generally will engage in particular acts that are considered inappropriate, and some are of a sexual nature. But here he makes these strange comments, these sexual comments to women. But he should be strictly celibate, and he should be, you know, should remain chaste and not engage in any sexual activity whatsoever. And but the reason they do this is they say there's three levels of impurity that we have. We have the impurity of the body, the impurity of the mind, and the impurity of the self, sort of the residue that clings to the self from past lives and so on. And he says they say the impurity of the body, that you get rid of by bathing in ashes, and by acting strangely, by being cursed by people and so on. The impurities of the mind, this is kind of a slightly odd. I mentioned that they should not talk with or look at women and shudras, and should not look at feces and urine. The Kaundinya explains that they should not the three impurities of the mind are aversion, anger, and desire or lust. And he says aversion is overcome by not looking at feces and urine, because they are an object of aversion, and so you become disgusted by it, and so you stay away from those things, so you don't sort of surround yourself with those kind of things. Desire is of course created by sort of the interaction between the sexes, and so you stay away from women. And anger, Kaundinya says, comes from shudras. If you interact with shudras, you'll get angry. So you stay away from them. And so then you come to the purity of mind, and finally you come to the purity of the self, which is obtained through the... that one is obtained through the curses of other people. The first one, the body, is just purely by bathing in ash. And then, but by being cursed by others, you obtain a purity of self, and once you obtain that purity of self, then you can enter into yoga. And yoga, they repeatedly say, yoga means the union of the self with Pashupati, with Shiva. Now, Shiva for them has both a manifest and an unmanifest form, so a form that has form and a form that is formless, sort of an aspect that is formless. The formless aspect is beyond their speech, and so they don't say much about that. The aspect that has form is the aspect that pervades this world, and is the aspect that is, you know, addressed as Shiva and Rudra and Mahadeva and all the names that generally are associated with Shiva. Their understanding of liberation is very, in some ways, although they say it's beyond the liberation of Sankhya, it sort of has a Sankhyan feel to it. They say liberation is a state of union with Shiva, but there's individuality there. You do not become Shiva, but you obtain the qualities of Shiva. And we see this as a very typical Shaiva way, or dualist Shaiva way of thinking about liberation. And you obtain the attributes of Shiva, and so you become omniscient, you become powerful, you obtain the majesty of Shiva and so on, except in relation to creation. So Shiva is the only one who can create worlds and stuff like that. So and Shiva always retains his uniqueness. He's different from all the other beings that are in the realm of liberation, or in the state of liberation, because he is the only original one. And but in other respects, everyone else has the same qualities as Shiva, except in relation to creation. There's no sense that you find in a Vaishnava text that the state of liberation is one of servitude to the deity. Vaishnavas insist that in the state of liberation, you're still dependent on Vishnu, and it's a state of kankari, of servitude, in this sort of you attend to Vishnu. Shaivas say, no, this is a Pashupata actually said, this is a bad idea. This is not a very sound idea, because dependence means suffering, and so you have to obtain independence, and so this is a state you obtain. The important thing to understand, though, is that though they act really weirdly, and their spiritual practice is kind of a bit odd, their path is, they see their path as being a devotional path, And so they, for them, this whatever they do, they're acting inappropriately in public places and so on, is merely meant to obtain a purity of mind, purity of the self, by which they can then meditate with sort of a devotional sentiment on Shiva. I gave you this passage there, which is quite interesting, on page 3, transcendent giving, sacrifice, and austerity, which is where they criticize the other practices of other people. I'll just read you the first paragraph there. The giving of cows, land, gold, shining metals, and other items are worthless giving. They're not. They don't have any value. Why? For they bring about a result which is not final, not absolute, and inferior. And also because we have scriptural evidence of there being the wrong path. This is a reference to a later passage in the Pashupata Sutras. Thus, the prefix ati here is a qualification. And so they say, this is he's commenting on the word ati dana. Dana means giving, and ati means beyond. So Hara who translated this put it as transcendent giving, sort of the giving beyond, the beyond giving. And so ati here qualifies the dana. Transcendent giving, ati dana, is the offering of oneself. Why? Because oneself is the ultimate agent of giving, and there's no need for any other gift than that. It is transcendent also because it does not lead him to the cycle of rebirth. The offering of oneself is called transcendent giving because it leads him to the presence of Rudra finally and absolutely, because it brings about the final non-return liberation, and because its result is unique. And so this is their understanding. It's you give yourself entirely to God, to Rudra. And again, he has a similar commentary on sacrifice. You have transcendent sacrifice and finally transcendent austerity, which consists of the other two. And so this is their understanding. It's sort of a peculiar form of bhakti, I suppose. But it's they see it as a form of devotion. Let's leave it at that. We're running out of time. You have at the end of the Kapalikas, I'll say a bit about them next week. They're often seen as an offshoot of Pashupata, but and you have a bibliography there at the end in case you're interested in them. Minoru Hara's book is quite good, Pashupata Studies. The last one you have there. It's quite a good study of their weird behavior and so on. Okay.